the framed items that you see in the back are currently hanging at the Beckman Institute, which is at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. This is a bunch of pieces I did more or less for myself. These are numbered something like 824 and 825. And this one is, the official title is Cube Descending a Staircase, but I really wanted to call it Cube Fuck and nobody would let me do that. So it was a matter of taking two Mathematica images, putting them in Illustrator, hitting the interpolating button and seeing what happened. But I'm not going to talk about these pieces. The things that I'm going to talk about are available on my web page, and I see that we have widening problems. They're on the Math Art page, and I'll also put this talk on that web page. I have some music, and we'll play that here. This is a piece of music that I wrote several years ago based on the Bach Beat Flat invention. I'll let you listen to that while I get the talk ready. Getting bored because I've heard it before, so let me switch it off. Many years ago, I saw work of Tony Robbins in a gallery in Texas, and then I met Tony Robbins about 15 years after, maybe 10 years after I'd seen the work, and I said, "Hey, I've seen your work somewhere." And we traced where it was, and it was a piece of, it was a painting that was depicting, clearly to me, depicting things from the fourth dimension. And this was a unique experience for me because I had found an artist who was speaking directly to me who wasn't somebody who I knew beforehand. So most of my friends who are artists were friends before they were artists. And so the dynamic is very much a different dynamic. And I've looked a lot at his paintings, and I'm very much in an imitative phase in my own artwork. I am a mathematician. I like drawing things in the fourth dimension, but I have to lay homage to the master of doing that, who is Tony Robbins, and just whatever I'm doing, I feel is a pale imitation of that. The mathematics behind what I'm going to show you today is this matrix up here. We're going to map four space into two space by means of this matrix. So the actual length of this line segment is 3/2 of an inch, and the actual length of this line segment is 2 upon the square root of 2. The actual length of this line segment is 3/2 of an inch, and this is also 2 upon square root of 2/2 of an inch, so square root of 2/2 of an inch. And so this is where the first, second, third, and fourth axes in four space are projecting. Now the reason for the choice of this matrix is, I guess related to one of the talks we heard this morning, is it a regular octahedron? No, it's not a regular octahedron. But it's very convenient because the vertices land on lattice points. And for the from the point of view of the human, then it looks like it's a regular octahedron. This is the 1, 2, 3 cube. This cube here would fit in the hypercube here. This is the 1, 2, 4 cube. It fits right here. There are two copies there. There's the 1, 3, 4 cube and the 2, 3, 4. And just in, this is not art, this is a mathematical model, please. These are just pushed off in the 4, 3, 2, and 1 direction. So oops, I'm using the wrong pointer. 4, 3, 2, and 1 directions there. There are a couple of structures within this hypercube that I want to concentrate upon. The first is the set of 6 planes, the 1, 2 plane, which is here in red, the 1, 3 plane, which is here in green, the 1, 4 plane, which is, where is the 1, 4 plane, is here in orange, and then the 2, 3, 2, 4, and 3, 4 plane. So let's see where they are. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. 1, 4 is white, blue, light blue. 3, 4 is orange, and then the 2, 3, 2, 4 plane is dark blue. I've positioned some of these planes off of where I want to look at them. In fact, where I want them to be is right there. And you'll observe that in the hypercube, those of you who don't know this, you have 3 planes intersecting along an edge, because this edge is a vertex times a time interval, and you'll have any 2 cubes intersecting along a face. If you color in all of the faces of the hypercube, things get very muddy. And this is muddy even though I've done some transparency gradations with the faces here. And all of these cubes have all 6 faces that are colored in, and there's no rhyme or reason on what's showing above or below. It just was, I just moved the levels or the transparencies until it looked reasonably good here. The other object within the hypercube I'm looking at is right isosceles triangle times a right isosceles triangle. So that would be the red right isosceles triangle times the blue isosceles triangle. The red isosceles triangles, this one has vertices 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and then the other 2 are translates of that. And in the blue, these are translates of those. The reason that this is truncated is because it actually fell off the canvas, and I didn't want to reposition things so that we would be able to have this type of effect on the, within the PDF file. So in those triangles, we have 3 prisms. This one, and then the one that's not depicted in the reddish direction. And we have 3 prisms in the bluish direction. This one, and the one that's not depicted. Those 2 sets of 3 prisms will form a linking pair of solid tori, which are the linking solid tori that form the 3-dimensional sphere. It's just we have a PL model of that. And these are all the 3-dimensional skins of the hypercube. I should mention why I'm interested in this figure for the mathematicians in the audience. So the answer to that question is a question. If the integral of x squared is 1/3, integral of x squared from 0 to 1 is 1/3, then what's it 1/3 of? Well, it's 1/3 of the volume of a cube. And combinatorially, there's a wonderful theorem that says if you sum the cubes up from 1 to n, then that's going to be the square of a triangle. And Dylan Thurston was at a conference in Vietnam, and I was talking to him about this and said, well, can you see geometrically why the cone on a cube is the square of a triangle? I said, no, I've never been able to do that. And he said, well, you're not going to see it directly combinatorially, but decompose it, and I still didn't get it, so he told me the solution. There's a way of slicing this figure into 2 pieces, each of which is the cone on a prism, and those 2 cones and prisms can be reassembled to be the cone on a cube. So I just got fascinated with the figure and started to play with it. This is, in this particular series, this is the first piece in the series, and there are these triangle times triangles that are populating four space, and they're also populating the four basic cubes, the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4, 1, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4 cubes. They're offset in some sense, and there may not be any reasonable reason that they're offset other than so that I can see them. I want to zoom in a little bit. Even though the figure winds up being busy with lines, as you focus in upon it, you see that the lines do very interesting things. The square lattice is an artifact of the lines that are being drawn, and it's also an artifact of this octagonal picture that I'm drawing in. And in some sense, among the pictures that I'm going to show you today, this winds up being one of my favorites. Maybe because it was the first in this series, and after I worked for a while, I realized how well the picture had worked. Although when after I'd done it, I said, "No, that doesn't work. Let me try something else." This is a slightly different data set, but still with the same configurations. So here we see the 1, 3, 4 cube being defined by means of these two checkerboard patterns. We can see the 1, 2, 4 cube being defined essentially by these red planes. And I can't, let's see, that's maybe 1, 2, 3 is defined by these objects here. I have a lot of indecision in the process. So, whoops, wrong button, sorry. These triangles times triangles were included in the lattice, but they had to be taken out or else the picture got busy again. But then I sort of like it better with them in. Sometimes I like it better with them out. Sometimes I like it better with them out. I don't know. This is the same data set. It's pretty obviously the same data set, and I started to run it through some filters. I'd like to believe that I can play electric guitar. I really can't, but I like to believe it. And one of the ways that the way they believe it is that they turn the distortion all the way up, and it sounds really awesome. It's a lot of distortion. So I did that a lot with a lot of these filters here, is just turn the distortion way up and see what happens. Here I'm using some granularity, some pointillism in Illustrator to get the images, and it's pretty nice. I like that. It doesn't show up as well from that point of view, but it's there. All these files are available on the web. They're supposed to be 18 by 22, so there should be fittable in frames. They are PDF files on the web, and if you want a high quality print, then you have to at least pay me the cost of getting the print. This is another distortion mechanism. This is supposed to have some glass effects, but whatever algorithms Illustrator is using, it's not as sophisticated as the algorithms we were seeing this morning. Again, the same data set running through some distortions, showing some of the framing. And another electric guitar metaphor, or electric piano metaphor perhaps, is if you listen to early Chick Corea work, you can hear that he's on a Fender Rhodes electric piano and volumes are turned up really loud. And even though there's a lot of distortion, there's a very clarity of tone within that. And so you see some clarity of tone in here, but you also get these really clearly computer-generated images, distorted images in here. I don't know if that's good or bad. That's for somebody else to decide. It's there. Tony's has a piece that he's going to show you, and this piece here reminds me very much of that, and it was really an accident, but I think it's a fortunate accident. Again, starting with one data set, running some filters on certain things. My son kept telling me that the pictures were getting too busy, and so I said, well, okay, let's see, well, let's get him busy. I can't resist zooming in on this because that's kind of nice. Again, just turn it to 11. Same data, different background. It's in the same position. It's a matter of indecision. I don't know which one I like better. And same data again with some surfaces painted in for no particular reason other than to see what had happened, what would happen. This is still in the same series. All of these so far are using the same data set and just seeing what happens when you run through these. If you want me to zoom in, tell me. If you want me to shut up, then I'll do that too. We'll just run through them real quickly. This was actually one of the first experiments in running through these Illustrator filters, and it's also one of the best in my opinion. The piece is called An Ocean in New Mexico because I'm very fond of that pink and turquoise color scheme. You see triangles and triangles here, but you see them turning to organic forms elsewhere within the picture, and you get some good spatial sense in there with the overlaps. The circus came to town, Cirque du Soleil, and I liked their color scheme, so I thought I would see what I could do with their color scheme. This is a new data set, and there's a lot of emphasis here on the prisms that I showed you earlier, and within given planes, there are different prisms that are shown, and they're also reversed. So this prism here is the same as this prism here, but I've just shown the front and back face in two different fields. I also liked psychedelic posters, so I thought I'd try psychedelic colors as well. Leaving the hypercube that I used to frame everything in the picture seemed like a good idea. It'll seem like a better idea as we go on. And you get this very clear sense of the 1-2, 1-3, blah, blah, blah planes defining what spaces we're in. Now you know, because the planes aren't there. And these color choices are various Illustrator canned colors. Since I'm not professionally an artist, I try to stay within certain color scapes that Illustrator provides. The circus is almost over. It's time to get back to reality. And then we come back to this, which, after everything else, winds up being a very elegant form and deserves to be stated by itself. Then, of course, there are contortionists in the circus, so that's that. Same data set, different color choices. There's some nice things that are going on inside here where you get nice overlaps, you get different, these two are different prisms next to each other. Let's see. I have a hard time identifying which prisms are which without going back to the files. Everything starts in a notebook, and usually the notebooks start in airplanes when I'm bored. And so I'm sketching things out, and I'm shading them just with ballpoint pen. But I like the way the pictures look, so I wanted to simulate that. and I don't know whether that worked or not. Strangely, by adding the shadows, the figure becomes more two-dimensional than it was before. Same data set, different. Some things are the same and some are different. I like this little region in here and this in here. I can focus my thoughts on those. I think it's a bad thing for somebody who does art to tell you what captures their own imagination of the piece. You're really supposed to find it in the pieces. I'm trying a softer color palette here. And soon you'll recognize some features of this. It's interesting that by deleting those planes, they wind up being defined more than they were. So the 1-2 plane is really clear here, even though it's the 3-4 plane that's being defined. Anybody who knows about the fourth dimension in modern culture knows about the Twilight Zone episode, and our mutual acquaintance, Linda Henderson, has a videotape of that particular episode. There are color choices that are determined by this, and also the composition was influenced by a dream I had as I was preparing these. These were really prepared for this conference, and I was trying to get as many works as I could done. So I woke up one Sunday morning seeing frames in my dreams and said, well, that's interesting. Let me see what happens if I paint that or sketch it. And this was another version of that dream, combining two-dimensional elements and four-dimensional elements. And again, having this reference hypercube therein. I had the same dream a week later, and so I painted it a week later. And again, because I liked the first piece I showed you so much, I wanted to see what happens if I really accentuate the frames, putting in some distortions, and I don't remember what distortions there were, but the overlays of frames also created nice distortions within the lattice. And this was an exciting piece to me when it was done. It was actually the third in the sequence that you're going to see, but I liked it. This was the first in that sequence. Softer colors probably because my eyes were getting tired. And we have the spick and span phenomena where the image is contained inside the image. I didn't do that again. The files are pretty big now, yeah? Okay. The files are pretty big now, and so if I had duplicated that one more time and put it up there, then it would be impossible to download. When you have dreams, you're supposed to undergo cycle analysis. And so this is the same dream after the 10th cycle analysis. There's weird stuff that's going on there, Anne. The combination of straight lines and wavy lines. I don't know why the straight lines didn't bend. I still don't understand that, but they're there. And this is an entirely different composition. It's still based on my fundamental object, which is a triangle times a triangle. But four of these fit to fill with hypercube. You check the volume is a quarter. So I must be able to geometrically fit four of them together. So I emphasized all four of these, but I only drew certain faces of them. And then I laid them across two different two-dimensional planes. I do want to emphasize in it to the viewer, to the audience, keeping the central hypercube wound up being important. And the reason is that this is the focal point of the picture, but it's intentionally distorted. So you try to focus in on that region and it'll hurt, so it'll pull your eyes back to another region of the painting. And this is really one of the paradoxes that you experience when you watch a hypercube moving in space. The part that you want to focus upon will fade very quickly. So this does help depict how we multi-dimensional, although apparently three-dimensional creatures, how we experience these pictures of four space. I showed this to a friend who's promptly said, "Oh, it looks like Chinese checkers," which this is good. My principal region is up in here, and then there's some transparency that's going around. It gets more and more invisible as you go counterclockwise around. There's a lot of duplication of form, and there's also duplication of color, and that's all intentional. That's mathematically based, not artistically based. That's probably not a good thing. Same data set, running through some filters. Getting back into the surface colors a little bit, but trying to soften them up some. And the final piece that I did for this workshop was this. I'd like to have that in my beach house, I think. I think that's a good beach house print. Hope that this works. Yeah. So this is a Mathematica file that I put together the last time that I was visiting Tony. And these are five copies of the fundamental object. And they're sitting statically in four space, but we're walking around it in each of those six directions. And that's all I have to say. Any questions? Yes.
At this point, you have a good sense of seeing it in your mind as a static hypervolume.
We perceive surface, and we extrapolate solid from surface. In four dimensions, what we should be perceiving is solid, and abstracting hypersolid.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I can mathematically tell you where it is and what it is, but I can't necessarily visualize it. Visualization is a very strange thing.
I'll change the question. You can see a picture of a cube and you can say, oh, I can find my way inside of the 3D room. Here's the path, avoid
right.
The box collisions. Do you think you could do that kind of pathfinding in a hypervolume?
I don't know. Do you have a game that I can play?
I can make one.
I've been hoping somebody would say that. That would be a very good experiment.
Just because that's the question that I ended up coming up with as the avoidant question, visualization, and we focus on, if I understand the space, I can navigate it.
I think what you need, there's some people who are working on soundscapes for gaming purposes,
sure.
And I think you need to have some different soundscape in the same spatial scape, and that's going to be very disorienting because there's going to be a lack of coincidence between what you see and what you hear. On the other hand, between those two senses, you may be able to extrapolate it. You may want to use an olfactory sense if Liz Taylor will let you use that, because she owns the patent for smell-o-vision. Yes, go ahead.
I think it might be better to give three-dimensional object as images of the four-dimensional object?
Certainly.
Because there you have an orientation of the light rays or the viewing rays. You don't have any orientation if you just map to a two-dimensional space.
Let me.
That makes it difficult.
This, in fact, since it's a Mathematica output, is actually a three-dimensional object in the latest version. And I hate it when it does that. This is always the most scary part, whether I've actually completely crashed my hard drive. There we go. So this is a three-dimensional object. But it's somebody else's job to create those three-dimensional forms. But you have to decide, you have to make choices of how you depict surface, how you depict solid, and so forth. But yeah, absolutely. And there the kernel is only one-dimensional. Here the kernel is two-dimensional.
Would you mind showing the complexity of your code for this?
Code?
Right.
For this?
Yeah.
This thing?
Any one of your work.
This is Mathematica.
Right.
And I can pull up some code for that. I'm sort of a hacker, so this is essentially, I didn't know that Mathematica had a Boolean function, so I had to create one. This is just describing various ways of rotating. Tire means rotation. A is a matrix, and there are several different matrices that I might choose from initially. Again, I choose one. This is how the lines are formed, and I have a mnemonic. Things that are feline are lines, things that are avian are planes, and that helps me know what things are. And I programmed in Mathematica long enough that it would give me spelling errors. So if I wanted rules, I knew I couldn't say rules, so I would call it fools. So it's the Dr. Seuss version of programming. And this is going to take a while because there are some other illustrations inside there, inside the file. So it's trying to load those up. So these are some of these having to do with the integral. That code there is sufficient to draw this figure, and this figure. But the real answer to your question, if I don't crash the machine, is I don't know what's inside here. Sorry, I wasn't prepared for that one, that particular question. These are just Illustrator files. So all my objects are sitting over here, and if I want to see one set of those objects, I'll just put them in here. And it's really just cutting and pasting and duplicating. And that's why it was important for me to stay on the lattice, because I have to drop these things in place. If somebody can tell me how to get Illustrator to only have a lattice that's a centimeter wide or an inch wide, I'd be really happy, because right now its lattice is at a tenth of an inch, and when you're zooming out, a tenth of an inch is way, way, way too big. You want to land zap on the location. But I don't know how to. In XFIG, I know that I can make the lattice as large as I like, so that if I'm zooming way out, I can just drop it nearby and it'll drop right to the lattice. Yeah.
You're just talking about changing how many subdivisions of the grid and what real scale those correspond to?
No. I want to make sure that when I'm staying on the grid, that I'm staying on the half-inch grid or the inch grid. So if I pick something up and I drop it, even staying on the grid, I can be off by as much as a tenth of an inch.
And it's based on where you click on.
Yeah.
Click based on where you click to drag.
So if I pick this up, and I think I'm on grid. Yeah, I am on grid. Then, see, I really want to drop that at that point.
Okay, I see.
But it's worse than that because I may have everything visible and only want to grab something and then duplicate it at another point, but at this scale so that I know what's going on.
I understand.
Yeah. Control C is a very good thing. Yeah, I'm done.